thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran. This is the Fighter Pilot Podcast, Episode 6. This week, U.S. Navy Aerospace Operational Physiologist Commander Susan Jay explains how flying high-performance aircraft and pulling Gs takes its toll on the human body. Roll it. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Fighter Pilot Podcast, the internet radio show that explores the fascinating world of air combat. I guess they'll let me be your host a little longer. My name is Vincent Aiello, and I am just glad to be here on this journey with you. I hope you're enjoying what you've heard so far. And we have a long interview today with Commander Susan Jay, so we're going to just get through one announcement, a couple questions, and straight on to the interview. Our only short announcement is that we are now on Stitcher. I had said something about that on episode 0, and I had a comment on YouTube that the person couldn't find it and realized we had dropped the ball on that, but we picked it up, and we are now on Stitcher. So if you haven't already found us, in which case, how would you be listening to this? But anyway, if you're looking for another way besides iTunes or the website, now you can check out Stitcher. All right, on to the question and answer segment of today's show. My first question comes from Jakob from Denmark, who says, "Hello, greetings from Denmark. Loving the podcasts. Saw the post with the 1,000th trap on Carl Vinson and was wondering what carrier you served on." Now, Jakob's question, it comes in multiple parts here, and so I'm going to answer each one of them as we go. So first off, Jakob, thanks for your question. I deployed twice, each on the George Washington and Nimitz, and once on John F. Kennedy. I also have landings on the carriers Carl Vinson, Constellation, Harry S. Truman, and Abraham Lincoln. Jakob goes on, "Is it normal to swap around to different boats?" And by boats, he means aircraft carriers. And yes, Jakob, it is. For stateside air wings, it is quite normal to move from carrier to carrier because the deployment schedule changes and carriers sometimes need their nuclear reactors refueled. And it just doesn't always line up to go with the same carrier. So for the most part, it is normal to switch around. The exception to that is we do have a forward deployed air wing and carrier in Japan, and they generally stay together until the carrier cycles back every few years. All right, next question. Are carrier air wings equal equipment-wise on the different boats? What I mean is, does each carrier have the same number of EA-18s for seed and E-2s for EW, and so on and so forth? Or are they specialized for different tasks? Jakob, each air wing is, for the most part, configured similarly. We talked about this in a previous episode, and in fact, I took some grief from a friend of mine who flies the EA-18 Growler for not mentioning that as one of the squadrons, so my apologies to him and all of you who fly the Growler. But for the most part, you have four F-18 squadrons, one Growler squadron, one E-2 squadron, a couple helicopter squadrons, and what am I missing? I believe that's it. And for the most part, they all do all of the missions. And finally, thanks for inspiring me even more with the interviews. Going to apply for Royal Danish Air Force Pilot School in the fall. Well, that's great news, Jakob, and good luck to you. I hope you have a rewarding career flying presumably the F-16 with the Danish Air Force, and I hope you enjoy it. All right, next, let's go to a phone call.
This is John from California. With the retirement of the S-3 Viking, what happened to the ASW mission? Thanks for your service, and thanks for the show. Keep up the great work.
All right. Well, I realize that question was a little difficult to hear, but John from California is asking what happened to the anti-submarine warfare mission since the retirement of the S-3 Viking. So, John, thanks for your question. I would put that answer in a question back to you to make a point, which is what happened to the Denver Broncos a couple years ago when Peyton Manning retired? And, of course, the answer in both settings is that the team went on without one of its star players. So That is what happened in the anti-submarine warfare world as well. You know, that mission is not just performed by aircraft. In fact, the best ASW platform is another submarine. And we also have surface ships that perform the mission. And for aircraft specifically, I think what you're getting at for your question is from the carrier, there is no fixed wing asset that does that anymore. It is helicopters only, but we still have the P-3 and now the P-8 that is replacing it also on the air side of things. Great question. All right, next question is from Aki in Finland. Again, a multi-part question. We'll break it up here. At which point does the pilot arm the ejection seat? Are there differences if you fly from a boat or from a field? Yes, there are. Ashore, you immediately arm the seat right before takeoff, and then you de-arm it right after you land. And on the carrier, you do it a little earlier. You actually arm the ejection seat as soon as they take off the chains and chocks that hold you to the carrier firmly, and once you start moving, because if you lose your brakes and go off the side, you need to be able to eject in a hurry. And in fact, on a previous video on one of my playlists on YouTube, I think there's an example of that with the F-14 that goes off the side because they failed to put the jet blast deflector up behind an aircraft that was about to take off. So you do it right before they break you down, and then you can safe the seat again right after they chain you down after your flight. Next question Aki asks is, did you fly in an F-18 equipped with Mark 14 NACIs or the SJU-5? Did they have any noticeable differences if you have, quote, used both of them? So, Aki, thankfully, I never, quote, used either one of them like our previous guest Bloach did. But I did sit in them close to 4,000 hours worth of rear-end time in those. And so for everyone else, the Mark 14, also known as the SJU-17, and NACES just stands for Navy Aircrew Common Ejection Seat. So the SJU-5 was in the older F-18 Hornet. The SJU-17 was in the later model Hornet and all of the Super Hornets. Aki, the only difference is that on pre-flight, you look at a few different things on the seats because they are built differently. And when you are flying, should you, God forbid, need to pull the emergency oxygen green ring, it's in a slightly different location, inboard or outboard of your leg, and you just need to know which one you're in. And frankly, if you're in a hurry and you look down and it's not where you expect it, you look in the other place and there it is. So it's not that big a difference to go from seat to seat, and F-18 pilots do it regularly. Next, he asks, how much in trouble are you if you forget the master arm in an arm position after a training sortie? And from a previous episode, you might recall that the master arm switch is a lot like the safety on a firearm, and it is what allows us to actually release ordnance or fire weapons or guns on the aircraft. So, Aki, that question depends, and I always hate that answer, but it does, because if you're just out doing anything and you don't really have too much in the way of weapons that can come off your aircraft, then it's not that big a deal. A lot of times in the older F-18, you have to arm the master arm just to get the chaff and flare expendables out in training. But if you're dropping live weapons and or forward firing guns, and really, if you have a history of doing kind of bonehead things, and that's just one more indicator, then you might be in a little more trouble, because that just shows that something's going on and you're not all there. And we have, without getting into too much of a tangent on this, you know, we have what's called human factors councils and boards and various things where you look at, you know, anytime there's an incident or a mishap, it's always easy to say, man, we should have seen this coming. This guy got a divorce and he moved and his mom died and all these human factors. Well, the reason for these councils and boards is to try to identify that ahead of time. So if we have a young pilot who maybe is boltering a lot and leaving the master arm switch on, that might come up in a meeting and we might take a look at what's going on in this young person's life so we can hopefully avert a mishap before it happens. All right, let's see here. You also asked, when using the rudder pedal adjustment lever in the pedal position, is the pedal position adjusted with an actuator motor, or is it a spring-based system where you use your feet to move the pedals to a correct position? Aki, it's the latter. It's just a very simple cable and pulley system. It's actually the exact same on the Boeing 717 that I fly, and it's just simple that way. There's no need for electric motors to move the thing back and forth. Did you ever fly with Finnish exchange pilots? If you did, what did you think about them? No, unfortunately, I did not, Aki, so I'm sorry for that. I wish I had, but I'm sure they're top-notch. All right, that is going to do it for questions. I have plenty more. If you phoned in or called in or emailed, I should say, a question, please be patient. I've got a long interview today. And frankly, next week with Top Gun, it'll be the same. But I want to get to those interviews and keep the show right at an hour. So let's get straight to it. Today on the Fighter Pilot Podcast, we are talking aviation physiology, pulling G's, air sickness, hypoxia, et cetera. And here to help us do that is U.S. Navy Commander and Aerospace Operational Physiologist, Susan Jay.
Hey, how are you doing, Cyclone? How are you? Good afternoon, Jello. How are things? Thank you for the invite. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. I think this will be a lot of fun, and sure, we're looking forward to hearing about what happens to the human body when we fly high-performance aircraft.
You got it.
But before we do, a little standard on the show here is we need to get to know you. So could you give us a little background, where you're from, where you went to school, and what your professional career has been like?
Sure. I am a native of Iowa, northeast part of the state, undergraduate degrees from the University of Iowa, so go Hawkeyes. And I was a college professor before I joined the Navy, so I have a rather unusual career. So anatomy and physiology. And I was interested in flight and sciences, and like I said, taught a lot of anatomy and physiology. And I knew the Navy had this aerospace physiology program, so I went and joined. I've been in about 21 years, 17 of which have been in naval aviation total.
Okay, so you're not necessarily a medical doctor, but you have specialty in the human body and the effects of physics, essentially, on the body. Is that basically it?
Exactly. Okay. So what I am a Medical Service Corps officer. So in the Navy Medical Department, if you are not a physician and you're not a nurse and you're not a dentist, but you still have something to do in the allied health fields and in the medical field, you are in the Medical Service Corps. So it has 31 subspecialties. All different types, anywhere from healthcare administrator, people who run hospitals, to physician's assistants, to physical therapists, research physiologists, and then aerospace operational physiologists like myself. So even though I'm in the medical department, I don't work in a hospital, I don't work in a clinic, but I'm on the flight line working with fighter pilots and maintainers and so forth.
And you get to fly, right?
I get to fly.
Cool.
Yes, it's a requirement for our job.
Okay.
So we go through, physiologists, we go through the exact same training that other aircrew, other fighter pilots go through. We go through ground school, all the survival training, which my community, we actually teach that.
Okay.
We do that type of training. We have introductory flights and so forth. And then we break off and do our subspecialty in terms of specific aeromedical human performance.
Okay, so you're an expert on the subject, and you go out there and actually feel the effects of it yourself and get to check that out. All right, excellent. All right, well, in episode one, Sunshine, whom I believe you know,
yes,
he touched briefly on the concept of G's. Now, you and I, and hopefully most of our listeners, are sitting here at one G.
Yes.
Tell us what a G is, if you will.
It is little g. It's abbreviation for gravitational force. So it's a perception of weight due to accelerative forces. So here, just sitting here, you're at one G. And in an aircraft, if you're flying along straight and level, your lift equals your weight. When you enter a steep turn or a banked turn, like 60 degrees angle of bank or so forth, your weight doubles. Your lift is twice your weight. So you feel like you're pressed into the seat, and your weight is now twice what it was before.
Okay, so it's the gravitational pull that essentially sticks us to the Earth, right?
Exactly.
Because of the massive size of this thing. And so our bodies have adapted to living in this 1G environment. But through technology, we have been able to go out and do, in the example you just described, 2G. So, for example, if I weigh 200 pounds and I turn 60 degrees angle of bank and I pull 2Gs, I literally weigh 400 pounds. If I was sitting on a scale, it would say 400. Mm-hmm. Okay,
exactly.
That's pretty impressive.
Yep.
Now, I think maybe an analogy for the listener who hasn't flown or pulled G's might be a roller coaster or a car driving up and down hills. So at the bottom of a hill or at the bottom of a roller coaster, when you start to go up, or let's say on a loop, you're experiencing that positive G. And at the top of the hill, when you're light in the seat, you're experiencing less than one G.
Exactly.
Is that correct?
You're unloaded. Okay. So you go inverted and you're unloaded.
Okay. So in an airplane,
so
in an airplane, if we fly upside down, let's say like the Blue Angels or the Thunderbirds, but you're still straight and level, level, it's like if you have gravity boots in your doorway or something, you're upside down. You're 1G, but the other direction. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about the negative Gs first, because those are probably fairly easy to get out of the way, because we don't do a lot of those in aviation. But what's the significance of pulling negative Gs? What happens in your body when, let's say you're flying along and you push forward on the stick and you experience, you know, negative 2 or 3 Gs, let's say?
Is extremely uncomfortable, because what happens, the biggest concern pulling Gs is blood draining from the head, or blood moving in and around out of the head and so forth. Well, for negative Gs, you're inverted and the blood begins to pool in the head itself. And it's extremely uncomfortable because, let's face it, you got a really bony skull. So not a whole lot of space for the blood to brain or the blood to pool into. It's extremely uncomfortable, and humans don't tolerate it very well.
I see. Okay. So the air show performers, they can build a tolerance to that, just like you can positive Gs. Mm-hmm. But for someone who doesn't do it very often, it can have effects, what, on your eyes as well, right? You can burst blood vessels.
And they'll call it sort of red eye. It looks as though you've actually broken some of the small blood vessels, and your eyes are bloodshot, essentially. Okay.
Now, conveniently, our aircraft are not designed, with the exception of some of those air show performers, to pull or push, maybe a better example, negative Gs. So the positive Gs.
Yes.
Now, Let's talk very briefly about axes, if you will, and I'll try to paint a picture for the listener.
Okay.
If I stand up and I put my right arm out to the side and my left arm directly in front of me, my spine is essentially the Z-axis. My
Correct.
Right arm pointing out to my side is, let's say, the Y-axis. Mm-hmm. And my arm pointing in front of me, my left arm, is the X-axis.
Correct.
Now, we don't do, like in a car, you drive mostly what we would call yaw in an airplane, left and right. And so you have a little bit of the Y-axis there when you take a turn very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you screech to a halt, you feel a little bit of G in the X-axis.
Right, sort of a decelerative.
Right. But in aviation, when we pull, that's why we use the term Gs, we're pulling back on the stick. And most of the G is in the Z-axis.
Correct.
Down our spine. Now, that is difficult for the body to take, right? Because like you just said, most of our body is a fluid, blood, and most of blood is water. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So water is affected by G-forces. So what happens in our body when we start pulling positive Gs?
If you do not actively work to prevent it, the blood will begin to drain from the head into the chest or the lower extremities. And about 1 to 3 Gs, you will begin to get sort of blood draining or pooling. About 3 to 4 Gs, and these are positive Gs, like you said, you'll begin to get visual changes. Your vision will begin to gray out. Around 4 to 5 Gs, you'll get what's known as blackout, and that's visual blackout. That's not you actually passing out and going unconscious. And around 5 to 6 Gs, you actually will have folks that will pass out. And I would say, again, I need to emphasize, this is you just passively sitting there as the Gs are coming on. You're not actively working to prevent the pooling or the draining.
Right, and we can talk about some of those measures to prevent that from happening. Okay, so again, there's blood that's in your head and in your eyes, and when G-forces happen, because of the physics of it, the fluid leaves that cavity, and then, of course, if your eyes are devoid of blood in your brain, then your body doesn't function quite as well.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a quick story about the vision side of it. I noticed that when I used to fly fighters, we don't pull too many Gs now in our airliners.
Hope not.
I would get, so I think there's something about, and without going into too much detail, maybe you can tell us, but there's something about the anatomy of the eye, because it seems like the grayness comes in from the side first on the periphery. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. So what happened was, in my case, I guess one of my eyes, I think it was my right eye, would come in from the sides on both if I was not able to keep up on the G-forces and, you know, keep my vision.
Right, you wouldn't stay ahead of them.
And they would come in at the same time, and my right eye would actually gray over first. But if I was really on my game, I could ease up on the G just enough where I had a little, like looking through a soda straw in my left eye.
I was going to say sort of a pinhole.
And I used to call it my targeting eyeball, because instead of having my normal peripheral vision, I'd have to scan around with this little looking through straw to figure out what's going on and where the other aircraft is that I might be dogfighting.
Yeah.
And thankfully, I never pulled all the way past that. and got to a point where I lost
my complete vision.
Now, is that what we call ALOC or what is the A? Is that almost loss of consciousness?
ALOC is considered an almost loss of consciousness. Not quite, but you're getting close.
Okay.
So even though your vision is graying out or it's beginning to tunnel, usually an ALOC is... it's hard to sort of describe. You actually need to see the tapes from someone. We have folks go through training in a centrifuge, and you can actually see when someone is ALOC'd. They've not completely passed out, but they are definitely cognitively not there.
They're not all there.
They're not all there. So I would say that you probably have not ALOC'd because you still, I mean, you're obviously scanning and consciously looking around, even though your vision has grayed out or has tunneled.
Okay. And on that note, we're going to have a channel on our YouTube. We're going to have a playlist, on our YouTube channel with a couple of videos that you can find right there on YouTube.
Okay, good.
And I might even upload my own from the centrifuge that I did in 2013.
I have got mine as well, yes.
So we'll see.
We as physiologists, we go through the same training again that you do
in
the centrifuge.
Yeah.
And most of us will go through the same runs. There's usually five runs of various G's in terms of magnitude and duration and head position and so forth. And then usually by the time that you get to the fifth run, you're exhausted anyway. But we purposely will lock just so that we, after you've done, we will actually purposely lock.
Well, that's probably good for your credibility because you can teach it better to the rest of us that way.
So now it's like, okay, so that's what happens when someone actually G locks.
Okay, so we're pulling G's. We might start to feel the effects. Obviously, we feel the effects of the gravity because we just feel physically heavier. So our necks, all of our muscles that are used to, in my previous example, holding up a 200-pound frame are suddenly dealing with a 400, 600, 1,200-pound frame.
And think of it.
And the helmet on, too.
Exactly. Your head itself, just as it is, weighs an average between 10 to 11 pounds, give or take.
Okay.
Now, you add your helmet and your visor, your oxygen mask, night vision goggles, all of that begins to get loaded on easily. Well, now that becomes, 40 pounds, 60 pounds,
sure,
and so forth.
I mean, if you pull 5 G's, that's 100 pounds on your neck.
It's heavy.
So I'm guessing fighter pilots tend to have a lot of neck troubles.
Yes, and back. And that's one of the preventive measures that as physiologists and with flight surgeons that we work with hard to have good physical fitness programs, stretching, flexibility, weightlifting, so that it's not just the muscles that will help you with your G strain to help you prevent G-locking and so forth, but it's also to build up the neck muscles and so forth so that you can keep your head up and you can keep scanning and looking.
And just tolerate the G's better.
Yes.
Now, I don't know if this is just anecdotal, so you can tell me now in front of everyone. It seemed to me like the tall, skinny runners were not very good at tolerating G-forces, and the short squat muscle lifting, maybe don't have quite as healthy of a diet. But it
doesn't seem fair, does it?
Because there's less of a distance, right,
exactly,
between the brain and everything else. And if your blood pressure, I don't know, I have to think through this, maybe you can help me. Mm-hmm. If you have higher blood pressure, it's actually more resistant to blood leaving your brain, arguably, right?
Think of the distance between your heart and your eyeballs as a hydrostatic column, like a column of water. And essentially, that's like you said, that's what blood is. So the taller that column is, the harder you have to work to maintain that column at a higher level so the blood stays in your head. The shorter the shorter and squattier you are, or the shorter that hydrostatic column, the easier it is, to be able to maintain sufficient positive pressure, for lack of a better way of describing it.
Sure.
So that the blood doesn't drain out of the head.
Okay.
So, really, in the centrifuge, because, again, we do a lot of that training, we can tell when it's sort of body type, the real tall, skinny beanpole, it's like, you're going to lock. It's like, or the really short, squatty ones, it's like, no, you're gonna knock this out of the park, champ. You're not going to have any difficulty at all. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that in a little bit, but let's continue through our scenario of a person pulling G's, and in my case, talked about my targeting eyeball as I start to lose vision. At some point, if you are unable to stay in front of it or keep up with it, as they say, the blood has vacated the important parts of your body, and then you get to that ALOC that we talked about, and then G-LOC itself. So what happens there? I mean, are you literally asleep, or are you just unconscious, or a little of both?
You have literally passed out.
So your body is just incapable of doing anything meaningful, not just for those, 12 seconds roughly, but right. for another 18 or 20 seconds after you come back, right?
Correct. So when we say that someone is G-locked, where they have a G loss of consciousness, there's actually two parts to it. There's a period of absolute incapacitation, which averages around 12 seconds. It can range anywhere from 9 to 22, give or take.
Okay.
But you are completely out. You've passed out. And you can see this on the tapes on the centrifuge. You've let go of the stick, the throttle. You're just sitting there. People will tell you that, they dream. They have little dreamlets, all kinds of things. And then they will begin to come to as the blood begins to get back up in the head because your heart's pumping and right. your muscles are contracting and it's working hard to get your brain rebooted. There's a period of what's known as relative incapacitation. And that too averages about 12 seconds, but it can range anywhere from 9 to 40 seconds. And that is a period of time when you're awake and you're conscious, but you definitely are cognitively not there. It's sort of like the lights are on, but nobody's home kind of thing, and you're sort of out of it. So an entire period of G-lock, 24 seconds, but it can be almost a minute.
Which is scary in a high-performance aircraft that
yes.
could very well start pointing towards the ground.
Exactly.
And if you don't have a crewman or someone,
an awful lot of altitude in a very short period of time.
Yeah. Yes. Unfortunately, that has claimed many pilots over the years.
Yes.
I think, hasn't the Air Force F-16 started incorporating some sort of recovery thing if it hasn't received a pilot input in a certain amount of time and it's got a certain profile?
It is called an auto GCAS.
Okay.
So it's an automatic ground collision avoidance system. So an auto GCAS, and what it is, it processes information in terms of altitude and elevation.
Probably previous G's too, so it knows
exactly.
if the guy just pulled 7 G's or something.
And it also has a profile of the trajectory of the aircraft of itself, and if it sees that the aircraft's trajectory is going to essentially run into the terrain, it will automatically roll upright and pull a 5 G, so that the aircraft itself will. At least until you terrain clearance is assured.
Wow.
So it will take over and fly the aircraft for you.
And I don't remember how many, but I know that has saved a couple
pilots.
It
has. I've seen reports anywhere from 4 to 7 confirmed
wow.
saves. So, and the Air Force has it in not all, but some of their F-16.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Navy and the Marine Corps don't have it installed in any of their aircraft yet, but I just saw something the other day where it's being installed in the F-35,
well,
the
good.
Joint Strike Fighter,
okay.
and it's coming online about 5 years before it was scheduled.
Oh, good.
Which I think is very good.
That's unusual for the military.
It should be standard. Exactly. It should be standard issue. So.
All right. Well, Cyclone, let's go back to the guy who's passed out
mm-hmm.
and starts coming around. The body does some sort of reboot, right? What's this funky chicken thing?
The funky
that you
chicken.
See in the videos?
Oh, yes. So that literally is your brain rebooting. So large muscles, when they contract, voluntary muscles will help push or force blood back up into the head. And that's exactly what the brain is trying to do. It's like, okay, I need to get more blood up into my head, up to my eyeballs. And that's essentially what the funky chicken is. It's just it looks like a seizure, but it's not. So it should only last for a couple of seconds. If it lasts more than 5 to 10, that's a seizure and that's a problem. But it really, from a medical perspective, it really does look like someone is having a seizure. So.
And again, if people want to look at the videos on the playlist I'm going to include in this, they'll see people go through that.
Go through the funky chicken.
It's kind of embarrassing, but it's not your fault.
And that's perfectly normal.
Right.
Your body, that's the best way for your body to get the blood back up into your head. The only hitch is you realize where the ejection seat handle is, right between your legs, and if your arms are flailing, which for some folks they can, it can be very easy to catch the handle.
Yikes.
And now you have issues or a potential problem that you pull or partially pull the ejection
wow.
seat handle.
Has that ever happened? Do we know?
No, but we know that some people have gotten themselves caught
wow.
partially on the handle.
That's scary.
So.
Okay. All right. So is there any lasting effect on the body as far as pulling? No, so let me just give you a quick story. When I went to the centrifuge in 2013, I ended up, I think it's the capillaries on my skin. I pulled 9 Gs for, I think, 15 seconds in order to fly the F-16. And that night, I was purple. I mean, it's embarrassing, but I actually took pictures of myself.
Because you had speed measles is what it's called.
I had massive purple bruising, and I don't normally get that in the airplane, so I don't know if the centrifuge is different, but aside from some busted capillaries that take a week to heal, and right. It itches a little bit.
Yeah, it's called petechia. It's speed measles.
Okay. Yeah. Is there any, once you're done pulling G's, is there any, for a person who spent a career flying fighters, is there any lasting effects of pulling G's?
No, other than what you had alluded to earlier with, your neck and back pain.
Okay.
So yes, there's a potential for that for long term.
Okay. But the blood leaves the eyes and the brain, blood comes back in the eyes and brain, and everything's still okay.
No, not that we know of. Yeah.
Okay. Outstanding. If you've always dreamt of a career in aviation while keeping your feet on the ground, then Air Corps Aviation is the place for you. Since 2008, Air Corps Aviation has been at the forefront of modernizing the airworthiness of legacy aircraft dating back to World War II. Their dedicated team specializes in numerous aerospace disciplines, including manufacturing, fabrication, restoration, and support, all while incorporating state-of-the-art technology. In 2024, Air Corps Aviation is expanding its team with job openings in engineering and computer-aided design, quality, fabrication, and restoration. Live where others vacation in northern Minnesota while enjoying paid time off, health insurance and savings accounts, retirement plans, life insurance, and best of all, most Fridays off. If you're ready to be a part of a team fulfilling dreams through the preservation of historical aircraft, visit aircorpsaviation.com/careers and take your first step towards an exciting career in aviation. That's aircorpsaviation.com/careers. Visit today. Now, we have a few methods and some equipment to help us tolerate G-forces. One of those we talked about in episode 3 with Vern. I think you know him too, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Okay, great. Yep. And that's the G-suit. And he told us then that when you put this around your legs and your torso, that it hooks to the aircraft and fills up with the bleed air from the aircraft, and it squeezes for the same reason we squeeze the bottom of the toothpaste tube, is to get the toothpaste up in the top where it matters, and that can buy us about 1 or 1.5 G of tolerance.
Correct. Yep.
So that doesn't sound like enough. What else do we have to withstand G-forces?
Probably the best thing in your arsenal is what's known as the anti-G straining maneuver, so an AGSM. There's two parts to it. There's a muscle strain and then a breathing cycle that goes with it. We tell folks to start in the lower legs and gradually work up to your glute region or into the upper body. So I always tell folks, start by curling your toes and try to contract the calf muscles or the soleus muscle, which is a large muscle in the back part of your lower leg. It's right underneath, your gastroc. So the big beefy muscles in the lower part of the leg.
Okay.
So from there, work your way up into the thighs, hamstrings, quadriceps. And then the biggest bang for your buck are the glutes. So your butt muscles.
Okay.
And some folks have got bigger butts than others, so you have an advantage.
That's right.
So your glutes are large muscles around the hips and very powerful muscles. And if you can contract those, that will really help to increase or improve your strain.
So this makes sense. You start at the bottom and work up because if you start in the middle, you could force blood down theoretically.
Exactly.
So you want to start down there and work up.
And like I said, you only want to work as hard as you have to. So if you can get away with, like if you have large thigh muscles or a very efficient strain where you just your lower legs and your thighs, and that's sufficient to help keep the blood in your head.
Okay.
Why work any harder than you have to? Because doing a good anti-G straining maneuver can get exhausting.
So for people who aren't aware, they'll have to pardon the analogy, but it's a little bit like trying to take care of business. I mean, you're really bearing down. Now, that case, you're trying to get something to go a different direction.
Exactly.
But in this case, we're trying to keep the blood up on our head. Now, so I purposely did not warn you, Cyclone.
No.
Are you willing to demonstrate an AGSM for us? Are you?
Let me do this.
Right.
Okay. So the best thing is probably, like I said, the AGSM, you start the lower legs and then you work your way up.
Uh-huh.
So, and one of the best training techniques or visualizations, for lack of a better way of describing it, visualize you have a wallet or a walnut.
Walnut, okay.
Take the walnut, put it between your butt cheeks.
Okay.
Now, using your butt cheeks and nothing but your butt cheeks, crack the nut.
So you're trying to bear down on that thing.
Bear down and crack the nut using your butt cheeks. You should rise out of the seat just a little bit, but that is so if you hear somebody depending on the whatever you load up in terms of the tapes from the centrifuge, if you hear somebody screaming, crack the nut,
that's what they're talking about.
That's what they're referring to.
Okay. So. And then the actual part of the Hick maneuver, as we call it, the anti-G-strain maneuver, is the reason it's the Hick is that that word, correct me if I'm wrong, forces your glottal to close at a certain spot. And so what you can do is you can try to keep the blood that's already in your head up in your head. And you need to do this before you start pulling the G's, right?
Correct. Oh, yes.
And and so then if you go, hey, right? If you do a big, deep breath, you're going to dump everything out of
there. Exactly.
Right? So it's a real quick exchange of air. Mm-hmm. You're not really worried about filling your lungs with good oxygen because hopefully this only lasts a little while.
Correct. Just, a few seconds.
Right. But it's long enough that you keep the blood in your brain and, that quick exchange of air will put some oxygen in your lungs. So,
exactly.
If you're willing, give us a quick sound demonstration of a good anti-G strain maneuver.
So the idea is, again, you start the lower legs and the breath cycle is coordinated. So the breath exchange should be very short and quick, about 2 or 3 seconds. So it goes, hic, hic.
And you just keep doing that until either the G releases or, I don't know, when do you quit? Do you just keep going?
You just keep going. Okay. Yeah. And you get more sophisticated, better at it, and you can judge when you can kind of let off, when you need to bear down even more and so forth. But you should continue to do the anti-G's training maneuver, the Hick maneuver, the entire time that you're pulling G's.
Now, is a person always going to have the same G tolerance? Like some people, like you said, the short and stocky folks may not need to do that until, let's say, 6 or 7 Gs, but someone else may have to start it at 4. But the person who starts it at 4 on one day, is it always going to have the same G tolerance?
Your G tolerance can vary drastically from day to day, even within yourself, and it can vary from person to person. So that's part of the reason why you always do a G warm-up maneuver. Before flight.
So that's where we just go out, we just pull some G's just to see how we are that day, right?
And that's part of it. So it's usually, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's usually a 4G turn.
For about 90 degrees, that's
And then about 6
You just touch
G's,
6 for a moment, and then you ease off to 4.
And then ease off. And that just as you had said, is a chance to assess your G tolerance for that day, because it can vary dramatically.
Even on the first flight versus the second flight of the day. So if you had a big boom at night the night before and you're dehydrated and you're tired and you didn't eat breakfast, your G tolerance may be lower.
Exactly.
And you might know that as soon as you start pulling that 4 and you say, oh, wow, okay, I need to take it easy today, or make sure I'm getting in front of it more on my anti-G strain maneuver. Oh. Or if you've been flying a lot and you've been taking care of yourself with lifting weights and it's, your third flight in 2 days and you really built the tolerance, you may not have to start anti-G strain maneuver until, again, 5 or 6
Or maybe
Gs.
Not work not nearly as hard.
Right.
So,
I know for me that was definitely the case. There were some days where it came easy and other days where it didn't. And I think for me, the biggest thing was simply dehydration. I mean, it's really important to stay hydrated.
Exactly. And we always tell people, manage your fatigue, but probably the quickest way to lower your G tolerance is to be dehydrated, essentially. I mean, not only is it just blood pressure in terms of blood volume and so forth, but it's your body's cooling mechanism and all kinds of things.
Sure.
So, yes.
So just like putting all the proper fluids in your automobile, you need to do the same thing for your body.
Exactly.
All right. Well, what else on G-force? I have a couple other physiology topics I'd like to ask you about, but have we touched everything on the G's?
I think so, yes.
Okay. Well, if you think of anything, we can always come back to it. All right, so let's talk about one that maybe some listeners are familiar with, and that's air sickness.
Okay.
Now, when I flew my very first flight in training, I got sick. And on my second one, I felt sick, but I didn't actually puke. And by a week later, I was fine.
Okay.
So what is air sickness and why does it seem to go away? Or maybe it doesn't for some people. I don't know.
Air sickness is a type of motion sickness. So it's typically a mismatch between sensory systems, primarily your visual system and your vestibular system. So your vestibular system is your inner ear. It's your sense of balance. And typically those two systems, vision and vestibular, work together. But every now and then you'll get something that's a mismatch. And your brain has a hard time with that conflicting information. It doesn't quite know what to believe. And it's like, I'm just going to get sick and I'm going to puke. kind of thing.
Okay, so we are ground-based creatures, right? So
exactly.
Whether it's Darwin or God, you decide. We weren't really intended for flight. So we go flying, mm-hmm. and suddenly our vestibular system, as you call it, the inner ear, which is built beautifully for three dimensions.
On the ground.
On the ground. Mm-hmm. Now you start, you know, turning, let's say, mm-hmm. and your eyes and your ears may not agree, and your body says, hey, this isn't right. I wonder if I ate something bad.
Exactly.
And so I better get rid of that.
Get rid of it. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of people will say that that's part of the air sickness or motion sickness. That's the reason, you know, it was built to prevent poisoning. It's like there's something that's made you ill, vomit, get rid of it,
sure.
And that takes care
so
of it.
So our ancestors were trying out new berries and different things, mm-hmm. and one of them makes your inner ear mess up, and your inner ear tells your stomach, eject
that.
The last thing you ingested. So, yeah. All right. Well, that makes sense. So does it seem to go away for most people?
It does. Probably the biggest thing is being able to recage your visual system. So a lot of times, again, it's a mismatch between your inner ear and vision. So if you can look outside, get a good horizon, helps to get your eyeballs, your visual system recaged, that tends to anchor essentially the two systems together, and then they work just fine. This is especially true for students. So for them, air conditioning, something that helps cool them off, make sure they're on oxygen. You know, if you're above 10,000 feet, you're going to be on oxygen anyway, but sometimes they're below that because where they're working, taking some good deep breaths of oxygen helps to kind of clear their head and so forth. Probably the most important thing, other than, like I said, getting a good visual cue or horizon, stay busy or active in the flight. It's really hard to puke when you're flying the plane. So I too, on the first couple of flights, we'd get airsick. So my instructor pilot would have me fly. And sure enough, I'm busy actually trying to pilot the aircraft, and it really is hard to puke when you're flying the plane.
Well, not just actually doing it, but isn't there something about the tactile feel, mm-hmm. where your body can also help communicate?
Exactly. Yep.
Okay.
And it, really, the biggest thing is just habituation. So you said, you know, the first flight, you got sick. Second one, yeah, I didn't feel so well, but didn't puke or anything like this. And by the third flight, it's like, okay. And for the most part, that's it. It's just continual habituation, because students will fly every single day, sometimes several times during, you know, twice during the day. The instructor pilots can fly up to three times. Mm-hmm. So it's just the habituation of it.
You know, I have to finish the story. I thought I was King Kong by the end of my primary training in T-34s. Yeah. My very last flight, I kid you not, I was in the back, and we have the little instrument shield you put on. So even if it's a beautiful day, it makes it look like you're flying in clouds.
Right.
And I thought we were done. And I don't know what I was thinking, but I had this small can, you've seen them, of pineapple juice.
Oh. Oh,
no. And yeah. I thought we were done, so I popped the bag back, and I'm going to drink this little highly acidic drink. Mm-hmm. And the instructor decides, hey, we're going to do some aerobatics.
Guess what?
So back came, at the end of all that training, back came my pineapple juice, not looking much different, but in a bag instead of a can.
When it came down. Yeah.
And, but I'll tell you, still to this day, or at least when I retired, if I got in the back seat with someone, so kudos to all the naval flight officers out there, if I got in the back seat and wasn't flying and was doing something other than flying, I would still get queasy. In fact, I could almost make myself a little queasy if it was particularly bumpy that day, if we were flying low and turbulent and fast.
Right.
So for me, it never fully went away, but it was always, like you said, with habituation. I just use the term building a tolerance, but same thing. It's always kind of right there, but I think your body just learns after a while, okay, this doesn't mean you ate something bad. This is just, okay. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So, and Naval Aviation, the training commands have an air sickness program. It's rare for someone to have intractable air sickness. I mean, usually after some folks, it may take them longer to build up their tolerance or to habituate. But we do have an air sickness program, and when we actually spin people, not necessarily in a centrifuge, but it's known as a Baroni chair. So, you spin. And then you have people move their head in various ways and so forth. And that forces you to get used to having your vestibular system provide input
disrupted.
That doesn't necessarily match your visual system. And that's essentially what you're doing as a fighter pilot. You know, you're moving, you're constantly looking around and moving your head. And that will get you disoriented until you get used to it.
I imagine. All right, let's talk about a big killer for military pilots in general, including fighter pilots, and that is hypoxia.
Okay.
You know, we need oxygen to live. I think everyone is aware of that. But as aviators, and not just fighter pilots, but really all, even civilian aviators have to deal with this, there are different ways our body can have problems transferring oxygen where it needs to be. And so let's talk briefly about that and why is it such a big deal?
So hypoxia just in general is a lack of oxygen to the tissues, and that could be in any number of ways. Most hypoxia that we think of in terms of aviation is hypoxic hypoxia. So it's a lack of pressure, O2 pressure, and just not enough oxygen. There's not enough oxygen pressure to push the oxygen into your lungs and get it into your bloodstream.
Okay, so for people who are climbing a tall mountain, let's say Everest, they have to adapt to this at some point.
Exactly. Or use oxygen as they summit.
Or supplementary oxygen, okay. Mm-hmm. So the higher you go, the thinner the air is, so there's just less pressure. Your body, again, wasn't really designed to be up there. In preparing for this interview, I actually did some research. The first time they started looking into this was in the 1800s because they were riding on balloons
Going
up. So they figured out that this was already a problem back then.
One of the very first incidents of somebody getting hypoxic was the very first balloon flight.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. So it's a problem for us because if we don't have oxygen, just like the hydration discussion we had a moment ago, obviously the body's not going to function properly.
Correct. Yep.
So we can pass out from G's, but we can also pass out from a lack of oxygen. Not just because it couldn't get up there because of the G-forces, but it didn't get up there because of the pressure. And there's a couple others, right? So if smokers have a slightly less effective system to transport oxygen.
They do. That's sometimes known as anemic hypoxia. So that's essentially carbon monoxide or other things are competing with space on red blood cells where oxygen would normally attach. And in this case, carbon monoxide latches onto the exact same spot, and it stays attached much longer. So there's no place for the oxygen to attach. So it's more of a transportation problem. There's more than enough oxygen. There's more than enough pressure to get the oxygen into the lungs, into the bloodstream, but there's no place for the oxygen to latch onto the red blood cell, so it doesn't get carried out to the tissues.
That's interesting. And then you can have a histotoxic type of hypoxia where there's something else at play, whether it's alcohol, narcotics, some other effect on the body that's impacting or degrading its ability to do its job, essentially.
We often consider that poisoning. Okay. So this is more at the cellular or metabolic level. So something has gummed up the works. The oxygen was able to get into the lungs and into the bloodstream, had no difficulty attaching onto the red blood cell, but when it gets presented to the tissue can't use it. Something's gummed up the works.
Gotcha.
So cyanide, which sounds odd in aviation, but electrical fires.
Ah.
Think of wires.
Cyanide is a byproduct of an electrical fire, correct?
It is, of burning, burning plastics. Remember from the first Gulf War?
Yeah.
Oil wells.
91, right?
Smoke,
so they lit a bunch
of
wells,
that.
But a lot of cyanide coming off of that?
That and just the hydrocarbons. The petrochemicals and
yeah.
you know,
okay.
the byproducts from that as well.
Very interesting. So I think people are familiar with why we don't drink and drive. Both the FAA and the Department of Defense have rules on drinking and flying. And it sounds like it's just bad all around because not only does it impair judgment and performance, but it lowers your tolerance for G-forces. It lowers your ability to transport oxygen in the body, making you more susceptible to hypoxia. So, yeah, that's obviously why we don't want pilots to consume alcohol within about 12 hours generally of flying.
It also can have an effect on the fluid that's in the inner ear that helps sense turns and banks and so forth. It has a tendency to, for lack of a better way of describing it, thin out that fluid. You're used to having that fluid being a certain viscousness, and alcohol will have a tendency to affect that. So now what would not be a big head, it would be a big deal moving your head around with that still in your alcohol, still in your system, can really distort the input from the inner ear.
And that's actually a great segue into another topic, which is spatial disorientation, or spatial D. So it also impacts that. Now, so spatial disorientation is another killer, frankly, of aviators. What is it, and why is it so dangerous?
This, too, is a profound mismatch. Again, usually between your vision and your vestibular system. So I usually think of spatial disorientation That's what you don't want. What you want is spatial orientation or situational awareness.
SA.
So SA, if you have good SA, that is your perception of the information. So where you are in your aircraft relative to the terrain and everything around you. And if you have good situational awareness, you can forecast what's going to come next. Now, keep in mind that's your perception, which is your interpretation of the information. So your interpretation is based on lots of things, how much experience you have or lack of experience, how tired you are, what you expect to see, all of that can influence your perception. And fatigue is also a large underlying component of that. You don't process information as quickly when you're fatigued, and that too can lead to getting disoriented.
So you can have a couple different types of spatial D, right? So you can have a sensory illusion where what you're seeing is not reality.
Correct.
Or you can also have vertigo. So you are feeling like you're turning, but you're not, or maybe you feel like you're not when you are turning.
Exactly.
And a lot of that, again, is just the mismatch between the different systems in our anatomy. Is that correct?
Correct. Okay. Yep. So you have three major sources of input. Vision, which kicks in about 80%, and it's very reliable. It's hard to fool your eyeballs. So you're very visually dominant. Your vestibular system contributes about 15%. And then proprioceptive, which is just a fancy word for seat of the pants, kicks in about 5%.
Okay, so scuba divers out there are familiar with you should never dive about 24 hours before you fly.
Correct.
And that is mainly because of trapped gas issues and decompression sickness issues. Is that correct? I mean,
yes.
What happens when we are underwater? What's the same effect when you're at altitude and go to higher altitudes on the gases in your body?
Got it. So underwater, you're under a greater pressure. And as you ascend to the surface, you begin to off-gas or release some nitrogen. And if you do this slowly, it's no big deal. You're able to exhale the nitrogen or off-gas it.
Okay.
And it doesn't become a problem in the sense where the bubbles get trapped in the bloodstream or they get trapped in joints or press on nerves and things that you don't want, places where you don't want the bubbles to get stuck. So aviation DCS is sort of same sort of idea, except you're flying along and your cabin is pressurized, and for whatever reason, you lose your cabin pressurization. So now
so it's like a rapid ascent.
Okay. So now nitrogen,
if you're up at high altitude.
Exactly. So now nitrogen, which is physiologically inert, it exerts a big pressure, but it doesn't do anything physiologically for you. It's not like oxygen or carbon dioxide, which are the breathing gases. But it does exert a big pressure, and it's dissolved in tissues, or it saturates your blood. Well, you lose your pressurization, and now the nitrogen bubbles out of solution. So it's very similar to taking like a soda can, shaking the soda can with a pop, and then popping the top, and all the gas spews out. So in a sense, maybe not quite as violent as that, but you begin to have nitrogen off-gassing or bubbling out of solution. And now you have nitrogen bubbles in the bloodstream, and as they get transported in the bloodstream, they can get stuck in joints, under the skin, press on nerves, and those are some of the symptoms of decompression sickness.
So if they get stuck in a joint, what's the danger in that? Is that it could clog the blood from flowing, and so if it's in your neck, let's say the blood doesn't get to your head, or if it's somewhere else, you could have tissue damage. Or
it's known as the bends.
Okay.
And it just causes pain in the joints, and achiness, and it's no kidding, it's just difficult to bend, essentially. It's difficult to move that joint.
So whether a scuba diver or an aviator who suffers DCS, the response is generally to put them in an altitude chamber.
It's a hyperbaric chamber or excessive pressure or recompression.
They squeeze them or press them, whatever the expression is. Thankfully,
so
I never had to do it.
I would call it squeeze. The dive doctors would call it press. It's the same thing. You're putting someone under a greater pressure, and the idea is to get the nitrogen bubbles to collapse, or because of the excess pressures, to force the nitrogen back into solution or back into the tissue.
Where it can't do any damage.
It can't do any damage. And you already have an advantage in aviation because you're at a higher altitude and you descend, so the pressure is going to increase. So in that sense, you have an advantage. But if you still have DCS symptoms, that's where you would send somebody to a hyperbaric or a recompression chamber.
But sometimes when you're coming down from altitude, you can have other trapped gas issues, like sinus problems, right? Or other aches and pains. I mean, what's going on there? Why do some people have difficulty ascending or a lot of times descending, whether it's their sinuses or otherwise?
A lot of times what has happened is you already have some congestion, so you're not able to vent the gas.
So the pipes are clogged that normally transport equalizing pressure.
Exactly.
And now when they're clogged, they can't do it as well.
They can't do it as well.
So you end up with a pressure differential, and then that causes pain?
Exactly. I don't get sinus headaches, but from what people have told me, it's like having an ice pick driven into your forehead. So it can hurt. So one of the biggest things is obviously don't fly with cold. Make sure that you're completely over it. You can also use things like nasal decongestion sprays, Afrin, and so forth. We tell folks if you have to snort that stuff before you fly, you shouldn't be flying to begin with. But you can use that, have it, you know, in your flight suit pocket. You know, so if you get yourself stuck,
it's
and you can't clear,
measure,
it's an emergency. Yeah. Okay, take some of that, and that should help clear it up at least enough so that you can get the pressure to clear until you can get safely back down to the deck,
and then deal with the problems then.
Exactly.
Now you can have trapped gases also in your gut. Right?
Oh, yes.
And that's just a function of venting that out.
Exactly.
Even in your teeth, I guess, right? Is that because of what? If there's a filling and you have an air pocket in it?
Exactly. Yep.
Okay.
So dental work, and in the Navy, we had 24 hours. So if you had major dental work, you have to wait 24 hours. You're grounded, at least until that ends. But if you've had dental work, like I have blown out a filling because I had an old filling and it needed to be fixed. So you will notice that on ascent because the gas is expanding.
On the climb, okay.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Huh.
So.
Well, our bodies are full of various fluids and gases.
Things.
And flight is a little bit unnatural, I would submit. I guess birds don't struggle with any of this,
no,
huh?
Okay. No. Well. But it's still fun because we adapt very well.
We do. And we have techniques and equipment and everything else to handle it. Well, Susan, this has been a really interesting discussion.
It's
Thank
been
you.
A pleasure.
What did we not cover that's important for our listeners to know about flying high-performance jet aircraft and the effects on our bodies?
That's about all of it. I think we've covered all the major, I'd call them challenges, not necessarily altitude threats, but challenges.
Okay. Yeah. Makes sense. Cool. Well, before we get to my final question, what's next for you? What's the future hold?
Well, let's see. As I mentioned, I've been in the Navy for a little over 21 years, 17 in naval aviation, and I'm going to retire in a few months.
Okay.
So have thoroughly enjoyed my career. I'm going to miss the people, but it is just time to move on. So
any plans?
The goal is to be an aircraft accident investigator.
Oh, for so NTSB?
NTSB okay. would be my preference. I
cool.
think that I think they are a cool agency. Would like to work with them and for them. But their FAA also has safety investigators, major airlines, things of that nature.
Okay. Well, you would be a good catch for any one of those.
Well, thank you.
I hope you find success there. Now, before I let you go, we have a tradition here on the Fighter Pilot Podcast
for
our guests to explain their call signs.
Oh, dear.
So, Cyclone, please enlighten us, if you would.
This is professionally embarrassing. All right. It's not what everybody thinks it is. As I mentioned, I'm a native of Iowa, graduate of the University of Iowa, so go Hawkeyes in Iowa City. There is another state institution of so-called higher learning about 2 hours to the west of Iowa City.
I think I can see where this is going.
In Ames, Iowa. And again, I will not name that other institution of so-called higher learning. I am named for their mascot, which is the Cyclone.
Now, that's just me. Now, who
yes,
came up with
is.
That?
Yes, it is. The senior members of my community, long, long time ago. So, yes, I am named for my college's major rival's mascot.
Okay, so it couldn't have been something cool to bless you. It had to be main rival across town or across state.
Yes.
And, okay, well, I went to UCLA, so that would be like if my call sign was Trojan.
Oh, there you
which
go.
Which could be disturbing, actually. I'm not sure why I just said that, but
there you go.
Anyway, all right. Well, Cyclone, this is why I usually call you Susan. I didn't even know that. But Susan, thank you for coming on the show today. It's been really fun.
Thank you,
and
Joe.
We learned
appreciate
a lot. And a moment ago when you talked about your 21 years of service, I failed to, as I will now, say thank you for your service. And everything
thank
you've
you
done.
Thank you for your support.
You're quite welcome. Everything you've done for pilots and your nation. So On behalf of everyone, we appreciate what you've done and the information that you shared today. So unless you got any parting shots, I think we can wrap this up and get out of here.
All right. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right.
Okay. All right. That was really awesome. I hope you enjoyed that. I apologize if we got a little technical with some of the anatomical discussions we had there, but hopefully you understood what we were talking about and you have a pretty good appreciation now of just how demanding it is on the human body to fly these aircraft. So our thanks again to Susan Jay and our best wishes for her and her coming retirement. All right. Well, let's see. What else is there? I think that is going to do it for this particular episode of the Fighter Pilot Podcast. As always, the views expressed in this presentation are the personal views of myself and my guest and do not necessarily represent the position of the Department of Defense or its components. Thank you for listening to the Fighter Pilot Podcast. If you have a question for the show, send an email to questions@fighterpilotpodcast.com or leave a message on our listener line, 877-MACH-101. That's 877-622-4101. Be sure to check out our website regularly at fighterpilotpodcast.com. We're always changing things up, trying to make it better. And you can also find us on all the usual social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. Please like, follow, share us with your network. And if you have a moment to leave us a rating and review anywhere where they support such things, we would greatly appreciate it. All right, well, we'll see you back here in about 10 or 11 days where we will talk about Top Gun, both the school and the movie. Until then, take it easy. Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.